You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode 259 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you as usual in different locations. I'm in Boulevard Park, Washington, home of the Pelton Cast.
I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
It's an exciting week. We're going to complete our 2021 Pelton Cast Hall of Fame class this week. We've got a special guest, third Pelton brother, a champion, to help us do it. And before we get to that, let's start off, as always, with this week's beer, which comes to us from our friends at Cloud Burst Brewing. Pick this up on our way to get the chicken that we're going to talk about a little bit. And that is the Cut for Time IPA. Here's their description, which is quite long. This IPA goes out to our bestest friend, unbeknownst to him, Kyle Mooney. Kyle is super funny and talented and kind of good looking. But week after week, his digital content on SNL gets cut for time and bumped off the show, only to live a quieter life in the corners of the interwebs. Not cool, Lorne. Not cool. But we were thinking, Amarillo is basically the Kyle Mooney of hops. It's versatile and fruity and bold, but it's just not as fire emoji as Strata and Mosaic and Citra and Simcoe, despite it being the buzzy IPA hop before them. This beer also includes some Amarillo hash, a high oil lupulin product, for an extra zip. The end result are big notes of pineapple and tangerine, more tangerines, with a kiss of sativa in the finish for those that like heady dank nugs.
Wow.
So a lot going on here.
Kyle Mooney. Look, personally, I would drink the Bo and Yang beer. what I'm about. This is the real Yang gang. The Bo and Yang, that is comedy superstar of the future.
Well, there's still time. There's still time for more Cloudburst Brews.
I'm in a petition right now for a Bo and Yang beer.
If Cloudburst is listening, which they are surely not.
I'm going to comment. When you post it on Twitter, I'll comment below it. Okay? So they'll have no idea I'm personally affiliated with the podcast at all.
None. Uh-huh. Few people do.
I saw Bo and Yang as the iceberg, and I was like, I need to drink a beer after this person.
Well,
inspired by this person.
Yeah, ice cold, obviously. So we start out this week on a down note. Some sad news.
You can taste the Mooney.
For some reason, I feel like that means like there's a hair in there. That's the visual I'm getting for tasting the Mooney. Seafair announced last week there will be no Home Street Bank Cup hydroplane races on Lake Washington for a second consecutive year due to the challenges of phase three of the Washington State reopening plan, which we may not be in for long. And maybe back to phase two for a period of time here.
And I think with that news, it's important that we get to some other news. And that's that because of this news, episode 259 of the Pelton Cast will be our last.
Oh, no. Like, they're gonna have Seafair will be back, the hydroplane racing will be back in 2022. I'm optimistic. I mean, it's a little strange because, you know, Seafair is in the first weekend of August. The NFL is like planning on having fans in stadiums. College football is planning on having fans in stadiums in September. I'm not really sure what the disconnect is here between August and September, except I guess that the challenge of committing to hosting the race now, as opposed to they don't have to commit to, you know, they already have Husky Stadium and Lumen Field are booked. They got those on lock.
I feel the same way, though. So maybe that's the issue. Right? It's like Capitol Block Party. Just book a festival. Come on. Everybody else is doing it.
I did not say that, for the record. But no update as yet.
We already did one hiatus. We will do another. Don't tempt us, Seafair.
The Columbia Cup, no updates there. All indications still that they're planning to host those the week before.
Oh, yeah.
There you go.
Look, the Tri-Cities may not be that far from home, but we are not at home anymore.
Oh, no. People don't get that. You just made a callback to something that's going to be later the podcast. So please keep listening.
Made a callback to something that's coming later.
So you get that reference.
Advanced level podcasting.
We had previously recorded, but it's coming later in the podcast.
Oh my God. I really feel like COVID safety wise, like being at Tri-Cities Waterfallies, what did you call it? Columbia Cup?
Columbia Cup, yes.
The Columbia Cup. It's Waterfallies Forever, thank you. And they're called Mexi Fries.
I mean, they're different things. It's like the difference. It's not the Seafair Cup. It's the Home Street Bank Cup, but it's part of Seafair.
Okay, Waterfallies is the general.
It's the all-encompassing festival.
Okay. Which Columbia. We'll see. It'll be nominated for Pelton Cast Hall of Fame next year. Waterfall. Seafair didn't fare so hot.
No, not so much.
Well, it was probably because they canceled. They probably canceled because they didn't make the Hall of Fame.
Okay. It sounded like you had a point coming and then you just stopped. No. Nope.
Oh, I don't think the way that it happens, like, you can be pretty distanced from people. And you're outside, like, it, all things considered, there are much more unsafe things that are planned.
That is for sure true, but I'm sure Seafair knows more about their financial challenges than we do.
I would say that that's probably the bigger issue. This isn't a Machine Gun Kelly concert. Like, they're not going to be making that kind of money off of it.
And happier news, congrats to UW Volleyball's LMA Powell and Samantha Drexel, named to the AVCA All-America first team, second teamer Claire Hoffman, as well as Leslie Gabriel, who was named the AVCA's National Assistant Coach of the Year for her role in leading the Huskies to the Final Four. You might know Gabriel better by her maiden name of Tuiasa Sopo. She predated her brothers Marcus and Zach, who played football at UW, is a middle blocker for the Huskies in the 1990s before beginning her 19-season run as an assistant coach.
Wow.
And is currently the team's associate head coach. The Huskies' run in Omaha came to an end last Thursday with a 3-1 loss to number 2 Kentucky in the national semifinals. UW did become the first team to take a set off the Wildcats in the NCAA tournament, a thrilling comeback in the second set before losing the last two, and Kentucky went on to beat Texas in Saturday's final to win the volleyball championship. And then lastly, in our toast, congrats to Brianna Stewart on adding a Russian Premier League MVP trophy to the one she won as WNBA Finals MVP and EuroLeague Final Four MVP in the past year after her UMMC Yekaterinburg team won the Russian Premier League title on Tuesday. So quite a year coming back from the Achilles injury for Brianna Stewart. With that, let's turn our attention to the Pelton Cast Hall of Fame. We had the listener vote for the sports choice in this year's Hall of Fame to go along with, to refresh your memory, Slick Watts is the direct elect candidate and Dick's Drive-In in the non-sports category. And so something happened in this voting.
Wow.
Which is that one of the contestants, one of the finalists, Lauren Jackson. The kingdom did not become sentient and retweet this. Lauren Jackson managed to retweet the poll, which spiked the results in her favor. She finished with 79% of the 225 votes as compared to 69 votes that were cast on the previous poll.
Wait, who is she? Katie in the Pelton Cast MVP voting?
I mean, you know, still Katie probably will manage a better margin than that. So Lori, the good news is, like, I think the polls certainly should reflect the opinion of the listener and not the internet at large or one specific contender's following. But the good news is Lauren was already well on her way to winning before she ended up retweeting this. I got to say, I was shocked. I thought Nate Robinson was going to win this, and Nate Robinson finished a distant last with 4% of the vote.
Finished behind the kingdom.
Yes. The kingdom ended up finishing second.
Wow.
It was close between the kingdom and Jermaine Kearse. The kingdom got 9% of the vote. Jermaine Kearse got 8% of the vote.
Wow. I thought Jermaine Kearse would run away with this.
The kingdom is having a moment.
Is Jermaine Kearse a 2-time Pelton Cast Hall of Fame loser?
That is the case, yes. Although last year, Brandon Roy kind of dominated. That's kind of part of why I thought Nate Robinson might be successful. Especially, we just talked about him all spring with the Let's Remember a Season segment.
Well,
critically
most
acclaimed.
Oh, yes. The most important thing to remember is that Lauren Jackson retweeting this poll goes to show how honored she is to be nominated for the Pelton Cast Hall of Fame.
Again, the most important Hall of Fame that Lauren Jackson could possibly go in this year. Forget the Naismith Memorial Pro Basketball Hall of Fame, which we'll find out whether she has made it as part of this year's class next month. The Pelton Cast Hall, I mean, it's certainly a more exclusive honor when you consider that, you know, we elected eight entrants last year.
Is Sue Bird in the Pelton Cast Hall of Fame, or did we just completely forget about Sue Bird?
We didn't forget about her. She's not eligible. She's not retired.
Oh, okay. Look, the rules of eligibility are pretty murky here. You have to be either demolished, right?
Yes.
Whereas Dick's Drive-In, like,
well, if in the non-sports category, the rules are a little different. It's more like the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame on that side.
Seafarer is, of course, retired.
Oh no!
Became eligible.
As a reminder to you, the current 2020 class included Ken Griffey Jr.,
okay,
Sean Kemp and Gary Payton,
okay,
the aforementioned Brandon Roy, Cube 93 FM, Loretta's Northwesterner, Taco Time Northwest, the Blue Scholars, and Radio Beer.
Wow, what an honor for Lauren to join those ranks.
Really one of the highest honors of her career, which included three WNBA MVPs, two finals MVPs in the two championships she helped the Storm win, multiple silver medals in the Olympics, a FIBA, at that point, World Championships, gold medal and victory in a year that the U.S. didn't win. Really an incredible career for Lauren Jackson. I mean, she was a no-brainer choice from the standpoint of being arguably the most dominant pro athlete in Seattle sports history.
Wow, pro athlete. I mean, we talked basketball, but most dominant pro athlete in Seattle sports history. Wow.
I mean, who would touch her from the other teams? Like, in terms of the combination of team success and individual success, like, I don't think there have been three MVPs combined from the other Seattle's. I mean, the only person who can touch her potentially is Breanna Stewart.
Oh, Breanna Stewart.
Well, Sue, in terms of career longevity, yes. But I'm saying, like, in terms of, like, winning MVPs, like, Griffey won one. Sean Alexander won one. That's
will not be going into the Pelton Cast Hall of Fame.
Oh, no. Look. Tough break for Sean Alexander. But to do that and then, you know, lead the team to two championships, like, Sue's in a whole different category because of her longevity with the Storm, the four championships now. It's weird because somehow I think the distinction I've drawn is Lauren is the best player in Storm history and Sue is the greatest player in Storm history. And somehow that makes sense to me. So to help discuss Lauren Jackson and remember her career in Seattle, a special guest this week is Third Pelton Brother, as I mentioned. We brought on the associate head coach of the Storm, Gary Kloppenberg, who more notably was an assistant coach for the team in 2001 when Lauren first came to the league as a rookie in 2002.
Yeah, I remember. That was a difficult year that first year without Sue. I mean, obviously got better when we got Sue, but I just remember Lauren just you know, she was really young then. And I think, you know, there was that period of just learning the league and how physical it was. That was definitely an adjustment for her. But I think what she was, in my mind, she was kind of like, you know, a little bit ahead of the bigs in that era. You know, I mean, she was kind of like Stewie a little bit, but before Stewie, you know, I mean, she could handle the ball a little bit. She could put it on the floor. She could step out and shoot it. I mean, she was kind of she could go inside and post. She was really complete, kind of an all around forerunner, I think, to what we're seeing now in our league with fours and fives, able to step outside, shoot threes, put it on the floor, kind of really, I think that's what we're seeing now is players that are just a lot more complete in their game. And she was kind of, in a way, ahead of when she came in early 2000.
Do you remember the first time you became aware of her as a prospect? Like, I assume maybe around the 2000 Olympics when she played for the Australian team?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, she was definitely on our radar. And I think mystery was like where we're going to end up, you know. I think in the lottery, or, you know, I think when we had, it was pretty well a done deal that we're going to take her early on. I remember a lot of teams. Hell, Detroit, they were trying to trade their whole team to get the pick to get her, you know. So, I mean, everybody knew about her. She was way ahead, you know, she was far and above the pick, and we knew she wanted to come over. She wanted to get her pro career going over here. So it was pretty much a no-brainer. And I remember Lynn, yeah, like she guarded that pick with her life. There's no way she was going to mess around or try to trade that for anything. So, yeah, she was a franchise changing player, you know. That's when, and when you're an expansion team, you know, they don't come along that often like that. And she was that player. And I think her career, you know, it bore that out, you know, to a couple of championships. And, you know, unfortunately she couldn't, I think her career got cut short, you know, several years just because of all the injuries. But, you know, she, within her time that she was in our league, was, you know, obviously a Hall of Famer.
Undoubtedly. Yeah. I mean, and you mentioned that, like, you look at, she's younger than Sue, and how long Sue has continued to play since LJ was forced into retirement. Her last WNBA season was 2012, and all the things she could have continued to accomplish if it weren't for the injuries.
Oh, absolutely. You know, that's the only, you know, the unfortunate thing with her was just, you know, hitting those injuries at that time. Cause she had several good, really good years ahead of her still. And, you know, even with the career that she had in our league, I mean, it's just unfortunate that that happened. But, you know, I know Seattle was happy that, you know, the great years that she had here, and, you know, what she brought to the team and to the city and to the league. I mean, you know, just a legendary career, honestly.
It was that next year after, you know, you were no longer part of the coaching staff and then were in Phoenix as an assistant coach, that she sort of really put things together, had that first MVP season. What kind of difference do you remember seeing? And, you know, how much of that do you think was just sort of getting adjusted to that style of play that you talked about earlier?
As I remember, she was good as a rookie. It's that for any rookie, no matter who you are, you know, there's that learning process. And I think her second, third year, you know, she gained that experience to really know how to play in our league and, how to score. I mean, she just was comfortable really soon within her second to third year. I mean, she was playing at a really high level. And I just remember we had to really plan to try to disrupt her. She was just so, so good inside, outside. And I thought, you know, her coaches, Ann and Brian, after that, they did a really good job of, you know, bringing out her strengths, you know, moving her around. I just remember, you know, she was always on the move, coming off screen. It's difficult, really difficult matchup to prepare for. I mean, I remember, you know, at Indiana, I mean, we tried our best to try to front her, not let her catch it, you know, trap from, you know, different places. I mean, she was just really, really difficult. You just wanted to try to make sure she didn't just hurt, kill you. You know, you wanted to try to, as difficult as you can, but, you know, obviously she was one of those players, you were never really going to stop her completely. You just had to limit her touches and keep her in traffic as much as you could.
And you had to do that in Indiana, despite the fact that you had maybe one of the best equipped players to guard her in Tamika Catching. So obviously it was giving up some size, but possibly the greatest defensive player in the history of the WNBA.
I'd have to look back at, you know, specifically, but I remember, you know, we beat them a few times at that year. One, I think in Indy and maybe Seattle, I'll have to check. Don't quote me on that, but
I remember the Fever being a very difficult matchup in that era.
Yeah, difficult. And Catch, you know, yeah, she took her on and confronted her. We helped a lot with her, definitely. And then, you know, you had to deal with Sue then too, you know? And so you had a double-edged sword with that crew. And that's why they were so good and won some championships, you know?
So Catch, you know, you mentioned the similarities, Stewie. LJ, you've coached three of the very best forwards and post players in the history of this league. How did they kind of, where does LJ stack up among that group?
Oh yeah. She's, you know, she's one of the best we've had in our league, you know, and I think you just don't get players, bigs like her, 6'5" players that are athletic, that can run, highly skilled. I mean, they just don't, you know, there's not very many of them. And that's why, you know, probably put her in that class with Stewie. When you look at those type of players that have come down the road in our league, is very, you know, you can count them on one hand, those complete players that are really like guards in the 6'5", 6'4", 6'5" body that can do everything that a guard can do, you know, and be able to go inside and outside. So, yeah, I mean, they're, you know, they were in another level. I think all three of those, you know, were at a very, very high level. You know, that's why they're in an elite level for our league. Ketch, Lauren and Stewie now still playing.
Now you say 6'5", a funny story from her playing career is for a long time when she first came over, she was listed at 6'5". And it often happens, obviously, that players are listed taller than they actually are. I think, you know, Tanisha Wright was like 5'11", but she was actually like 5'8". Lauren was actually listed too short. That got corrected at some point while I was working for the Storm, that we realized she actually should be listed at 6'6", because that's how tall she was. And then it really kind of amplifies, yeah, what she was doing as a shooter and a playmaker at her size.
Yeah, she was just, you know, just so versatile. And like I said, I thought her coaches did a really good job of utilizing her strengths. You know, she was just, I remember, just so good. They would, you know, move her around. I mean, coming off screen and roll, coming off slice screens into the post, coming back up from down screens up to the high elbow, you know, coming up, picking and popping with Sue and screen and roll and just posting up, you know, being able to go down in there and get to the free throw line. I mean, she just was so versatile that, you know, and I thought her coaches did a particularly good job of utilizing all of her strengths through the years.
Are there any particular moments or stories that stand out, at least among the stories that can be told on this podcast from coaching Lauren?
I only remember she made a basket at the wrong end one time. I think
I was there for that one.
Might have been her rookie year, and seems like she just came off the plane from Australia or something. And all I remember is, and Coach Dunn, we looked at each other like, I guess just a rookie mistake. I mean, yeah, she just like put the ball back in, and then
I want to say that was against LA.
Yeah, yeah.
And it would have been her second season, because I was there. That was an eventful season, because we also had the time that Simone Edwards passed to Doppler that year.
Yeah, that was kind of a funny moment. I'm not sure how that happened, but I remember that one. But no, I mean, I remember, you know, she had battles with Lisa Leslie, you know, and she, you know, one thing about Lauren, I mean, she was, you know, the core, the nicest person and funny, and you know, the man, she stepped between the lines. She was just so fierce and so competitive. I mean, and she was nasty. She got in, you know, she did not back down from anybody. And I know she and Lisa, man, they got in, you know, they definitely got into some trash talk and stuff. And you know, I know she always, every game, always was ready for that matchup when we play LA. And you know, I remember we had a few incidents with LA. I mean, I remember one time, I think she was playing that year, they walked in our shoot around and kicked, you know, like we were early and kicked us off, and we ended up beating them that night. You know, the players were so angry about that Coop brought his team in and kicked us off in the shoot around. Maybe it was a year before she was.
I think that might have been that same year. And I.
Were you there?
The Michelle Marciniak, Latasha Byers.
That might have been the same day.
Yeah, that's a memorable night in Storm history for sure.
That's an epic YouTube out of Marciniak. You can go look at that occasionally.
I mean, there were some great times. I also remember that season. The last game of the season against Utah trying to clinch a playoff spot. And I think Lauren had like 6 or 7 blocks in that game. It was one of her most dominant defensive performances to seal that.
One of those players, not only just a great basketball player and complete player, but she had that, she had that fierce drive, almost like, something that Catchings had too, just the will to win, just that fierce desire to win and compete, that was elevated. It was an elevated sense of urgency and competitiveness and elevated will to win that drove her. And I think that was that separates her into that other group too, besides just the skill and ability to play, is that will and desire to.
Yeah, it makes me think of, there was a photo we really loved using. I think this was the second championship season, 2010, where she's like folded down with her hands on her knees and delivering the most piercing stare possible. And it was really just a great, intimidating photo to use when we were doing stuff on the website that year.
And that was her, and she, you knew when you had to come up against her, I mean, it was going to be a knockdown, drag out war, and she wasn't taking any prisoners. I mean, she's, she just had that kind of Aussie attitude. Like, the one thing about the Aussie players through there is they just had that kind of edginess, toughness, and a lot of the Aussie players I've coached through, they just had that kind of toughness about them, maybe it's because they played rugby over there or something, but they were just always tough-minded, and really competitive when they stepped on the floor. And, I think Lauren was really exemplified that Australian quality.
Definitely, and definitely something that helped endear her to the Storm fans on above and beyond the production. Well, I'd be remiss while I have you to not first congratulate you again on your role in leading the Storm to the championship last year.
Thank you very much. Yeah, it was, what an unbelievable experience. You kind of, when you're in the moment, you're not really, you just, every day is just intense and you're getting ready for every game and getting, trying to get them to get everybody on the same page playing well, which I think we did. But then afterwards you kind of just take a breath of fresh, you just sort of sigh of relief, like, wow, man, that's a tremendous accomplishment. But I mean, I thought our players down there were just so locked in, so together with the chemistry, and had a really good coaching staff. I think mainly with a team like that, you want to keep them, you don't want to screw them up, so I was like, okay, sometimes less is more. And I felt like that was a situation where, like, look, we got good systems on defense, good systems on offense, don't try to do too much, keep everybody within their role, playing hard. And I think for the most part, we did that. And I think we finished, I thought we played our best really at the end of the year, after we got by that first Minnesota game. We got a little bit of luck on that one and we got by it. So.
Yeah. I mean, look, you're right about the talent certainly on last year's team, but I think that Minnesota series was testament to the way the defense kind of evolved over the course of that series, and by the end of it, Minnesota didn't seem like they had a lot of answers for what you were doing. I thought that was really exemplary job of coaching in that series in particular.
Probably should have figured it out earlier how we wanted to guard them. We finally, kind of got a good way of game plan and how we wanted to approach them, and they were difficult. And I think we had Stewie and Sue were out, had been out for quite a few games. That was their first game back, so it was kind of a tough one. It was a tough struggle to get that game, and then we got a little bit of luck right there on that play. And then after that, I felt like, okay, we're back to the way we were playing, pretty much for the whole year. And then I thought Sue, she was just unbelievable throughout the champion, the playoff and the championship. I mean, she got you know, the plays. I mean, it just felt like she made everything so easy, you know, for everybody when she's out there on the, and, you know, Stewie quickly got back into form, you know, and I just thought, you know, it was a really good effort. I thought our bench really helped us. And, you know, it was just a magical type of season. Honestly, it was, hopefully, you know, this year will be, we got some new faces and, you know, it'll be different, obviously, but I think we still have a pretty good core team and see how we can evolve, you know?
Yeah, I mean, definitely when you start with Stewie, Sue Bird, Jewel Lloyd, that's a really great place to start from. I was going to ask, how nice is it to be number one back in Seattle for training camp and for the season this year? And then number two, to have Dan Hughes back with you on the sidelines after he was unable to coach in the wobble.
Yeah, it's so good to have Coach back. I mean, you can see it. He's just, you know, he's just joyous and happy to be out there. It's just really good. You know, he's just such, he's got such a good voice. You know, I think it's just, it's just great having him back out there. And we're getting in our routine with training camp. And yeah, it's nice. And just being back in Seattle, obviously the league's going to really out with the protocols and just everything that they're doing to try to keep everybody safe within, you know, the situation in our home market. But, you know, it's like everybody's really excited. We've had a couple good days of camp, and I think coming along with the group that we have, and, you know, we'll have some players start coming back in, and, you know, really, really excited about this team. I think, you know, looking at that schedule, it's going to be really a real challenge because your games are coming fast. The games are coming fast like they did last year, but now you got some travel involved with it too. So it's, you know, it's going to be, I think, a really good, really exciting year for our league and for our team.
I'm certainly excited. You know, it's been a year and a half since the 2019 playoffs against Minnesota. It was the last WNBA game, last Storm game I got to attend. So we're inside 3 weeks now to the season opener, May 15th, and looking forward to seeing everybody on the court.
Yeah, it's going to be great.
With that, thanks so much for taking the time, Klopp.
Yeah, Kevin, I appreciate it, man. Anytime.
All right, well, thanks again to Klopp for taking the time. It was a lot of fun. And again, looking forward to the Storm season. Okay, so before we get to Seattle sports, let's do this week's Coach's Corner. You demanded this segment. My hopes are high.
Well, your hopes shouldn't be too high. But this was week one of the Pony League baseball season. Is that what you're in? Yes. Okay. Week one of the Pony League baseball season. And guess what? In Seattle, Washington, that means it poured rain on Saturday.
It sure did. Yeah.
All day. So two children, Baby Fantasy Genius and Baby Your Fantasy Genius, both playing baseball. As was documented previously, the baby has quit baseball completely for the rest of his life. which, thank the Lord that he quit baseball. But, so the middle child, his baseball game was canceled due to rain.
Rained out. Yeah.
Luca's baseball game was not rained out.
He was like the Mariners on Saturday.
Rain or shine, they said. This baseball game was going to be happening. So we're like, all right, screw it. He's excited about playing baseball. We'll do this. And then I find out that it's an interleague game, right? We're heading to the NL, so to say, for this game. And
was there no DH?
No, there was no DH for this one. For sure, there was no DH. But so we're traveling down to a place called Ravensdale, Washington, which I previously was very unaware of. It's like you just drive as far south as you can possibly imagine before you get to Olympia. It's as if you're driving to Mount Rainier, and that's where Ravensdale, Washington is. Have you ever once heard of this place before?
I can't say that I have.
So we're driving down there in the increasingly pouring rain to this baseball game. Get to this park that is packed to the brim of car. I was imagining like one field or whatever. I don't know why. There were so many people at this park. Fortunately, the fields are all field turf, so they were able to play in the fields, and I think that's why it wasn't rained out. Luca's team is gathered under like a tarp that's been set up, or a canopy that's been set up. There's all these kids crammed under this canopy. As you know well, the spread of COVID is happening largely in youth sports right now, so it's good to know that everybody crammed under this canopy. But at least most of Luca's team was masked. I think the complete team was masked. he adds, every single person was, including the coach, which was impressive. I don't know why it's specifically impressive that the coach was masked, but it is. He had some masking troubles. So, okay, we get to the game. Mrs. Fantasy Genius is supposed to be the bench coach for the team. She has taken the other children home and is not going to be hanging out at this baseball game, which... you know who that responsibility falls to.
Oh, boy. So we said beforehand, we don't know. You may be coach at some point, and there's, it didn't happen.
Like moths to a flame. I end up coaching children's sports. Against my better judgment and intentions, I will coach youth sports no matter what. And I'll tell you what, I just like bossing children around, I think, is the real reason. But the actual reason that I committed to this task, because I'm sure there are other people who would have done it, was because the dugout was undercover.
Oh, there you go.
Which was a real come up for me. And I was like, I'm in there. I'm in the dugout. Whether you want me there or not, I am going to be in the dugout. So eventually the game starts. And the team that Luca's team is playing, they're the Ravensdale team or whatever. They are. They're from Maple Valley.
They're from Southern Maple Valley.
Southern Maple Valley.
Yeah, Ravensdale is not as far south as you made it out to be. It's not that much farther south than Maple Valley.
Actually, I don't know.
It's more east.
The team that Luca's playing is 100% white and 100% unmasked.
Probably about, I think.
Oh, boy.
Every single player, except for one. In fact, you learned that player's name, right? Who had the mask? He learned the masked player's name. That's how amazing this player was.
Yes.
The one masked player on the team persevered.
He was a good pitcher.
So we're there. Of course, they get crushed by this team. It wasn't even close. They literally did not put the ball in play, Luca's team.
They did once, but it's a foul ball.
That's not putting the ball in play. A foul ball is not putting the ball in play, for the record.
Yeah,
you hit your team hit the ball once, but it was a no hitter for the other team. But it was not a perfect game, and I'll tell you why. Do you want to know what Luca's batting average on the season is?
Is it NAN?
NAN. And do you want to know what his on base percentage is for the season?
Is it 1,000?
It's 1,000. That's wow. Right. Call that Billy a... Bean. This is the Italian god of walks right here.
It's really like a very, I don't know if it's a Pelton or a Carasino trait, but that sounds a lot like my youth baseball career.
Some say that he was scared to swing the bat.
Yes, I was.
Some might be him. Others might say he's waiting for the right pitch and the right
working
pitch
the count.
Didn't come. Yeah, working
the
count.
He
says he will not swing at a pitch. So,
I'll not swing at a pitch until I get an absolute garbage pitcher.
With that said, as you can hear him hollering in the background, I wanted to bring in a special guest to talk about his first baseball game of the season. That's right. Baby Fantasy Genius. He had some thoughts post game about the masking of the other team, and I believe there may have been some, what are you doing? Some shit talking that happened by them to our team also. So I'm turning this over to you. Control yourself.
Okay. Hello.
All right. So tell us a little bit about the post game fracas. Can I call it a fracas?
All right. So the first thing I'm going to talk about, it was when I was playing first base with a runner on first that had just walked themselves. He said, we won our last game 17-0, which is actually impossible because there is a mercy rule.
Well, if 10. You scored, it cuts off mid-inning at 10?
it cuts off whenever the game.
Whenever you reach 10, so yeah, you can't, you don't get to continue the inning.
Entire batting lineup.
Okay.
In one sitting. Or one inning.
Now, is it possible they're playing through in different with different rules in
they
that
are.
League?
Yes, in their league, okay. They do not have to be mandatory last. Our league, yes, we do.
Okay.
And everybody did a relatively good job at doing that in the actual game.
That's good.
There wasn't any unmasked cases. I even told one, Isaac, I told to him, man, these kids are too selfish to even put a mask on. And he's like, why are these kids not putting masks on? I didn't even see that.
It's a good question. I may not have as strong role modeling from the adults around them.
Yep. And the adults didn't care.
What about post-game?
Post-game, really nothing happened. I was mad. We were stuck there for a little bit.
So they didn't say anything. The only trash talking was telling you during the game about winning 17-0.
I trash talked the coach a little bit.
about masking or about baseball?
I went like at the end of an inning after we got three outs.
You waved?
And he stared at me.
Okay. All right. Well, definitely sounds like an eventful start to your baseball season.
I hope next game is better.
It sounds like it can't get much worse.
I got an out though.
In the field?
Yes, there was two total outs for our team all game that were in the field, not just strikeouts. I got one of them where it was a grounder at the first and I stepped on base.
Nice. Well done. John Woolard style.
And then the second one was, there was, I think it was a grounder at the second and somebody threw it over to third.
I was going to say you don't get the John Woolard reference, but because of Griffey baseball, you for sure get the Woolard reference.
Probably.
All right. Well, we look forward to more coaches corners and more updates on your season to come, Luca.
Saturday.
Thanks for joining us.
All right. Goodbye.
Did she just flip us off?
I think it was giving like a peace sign. I can't.
Oh, okay. Okay. That's much better.
Yeah. Yeah. He's learning his shit talking. I'm teaching him.
Just kind of start him young.
I swear, he said that some kid was shit talking him on first base about wearing masks, and I was like, the people need to hear about this. And I was look, Ravensdale may not be that far south of us, but we are not at home anymore.
Okay, yes, no, that seems fair. Should we get to talking about food?
Yes.
So our search for Seattle's best fried chicken took us to an important spot, I think, this week. And that's a place I haven't been in a long period of time, not since the move. And that's Sisters and Brothers, serving Nashville-style hot fried chicken. Sisters and Brothers opened in Georgetown in March 2016 with restaurateur and Bainbridge native Jake Maney bringing the signature hot chicken to Seattle after spending 5 years in Nashville. And after a four-year run in that Georgetown location, which I happened to drive by earlier this evening as I was going to get takeout from Mezzanotte, which is back open, then it moved to Queen Anne in June 2020 in the former Chen's Village location, very close to where I used to work at the Sonic's old offices.
When I feel like it has to be noted kind of the similarity of these two locations. Like, obviously we miss the location being in Georgetown, but like if there are people out there who haven't been to the Sisters and Brothers, but have been to Georgetown, when you think Georgetown, it was not where you're thinking of, right? It was like in the flight path, and right. it was in a spot removed from downtown Georgetown. This wasn't like cool spot on Friday, Saturday night. This was like a little extraterrestrial for what's happening there in a really awesome way, right? It gave kind of like a culture to the location. And I think that for some reason, I was under the impression when they moved that they moved to Eastlake. And in my mind, I was just like, Sisters and Brothers sold out. This is fucking bullshit. And then
Then I disabused you of that notion. I was like, do not drive to East Lake. They're not there.
When I went to the current Sisters and Brothers location, it is the perfect spot for it, right? Like, it's a little bit grimy, a little bit strange, kind of out of the way. Like, when you say Queen Anne,
I mean, it's also been described as Inner Bay. To me, Inner Bay is farther north than that, is having also worked at Inner Bay.
It's almost, if you could take the Queen Anne version of where they were in Georgetown, that's where they are in Queen Anne, right? It's on Elliott, like just past Denny, in sort of this dead zone. And you would always
dwell, not a dead zone, because there's a Taco Time Northwest there, good
but
sir.
But it's even kind of far from the Taco Time Northwest, right? Like,
it's not right next to the Taco Time.
It is the perfect location for Sisters and Brothers to be. Like, there's something about it being in these like kind of funky little spots where it's just like, it's like a little bit strange and a little bit grimy, and you're like, that's exactly what you want from this location. So I was excited. It was pouring rain when I went there. Otherwise, I would have been pretty excited to have sat. They've got like a little makeshift patio set up outside in the parking lot. It's just like they own the area. You know what I mean? Like, there's a large bit of space that they are taking up with the location. They could have a full parking lot plus an outdoor patio area on the concrete in the parking lot and still have room for it because of the funky location that they're in.
Yeah, they're exploring the studio space. And I mean, one of the things, the reasons they moved is because the larger location than where they were in Georgetown. And that's kind of the bummer that I don't think they've at any point had any indoor dining since they opened this restaurant. But eventually, it sounds like that's going to be pretty cool. And I like the setup where they've got it kind of set up so that what would normally be the entryway is where they're actually dispersing takeout or for people to eat on the patio. So, you know, you're not going deep into the bowels of the restaurant.
And I really think maintaining that culture is really important for Sisters and Brothers, because
that fits the vibe
of what it's about. Yes, they maintain the vibe very well. But we're here to talk about chicken.
We are, yes. Not locations.
So we both went on Sunday. This was both of our first time going to Sisters and Brothers in that Lower Queen Anne location. You went first. You did the medium.
I did. And I told you that it was not quite as spicy as I remembered. That was my analysis. And I feel like I may have misled you on that because then you were willing to go for the hot.
Oh, always. When you say it's not, if it's not spicy enough, if you're telling me that.
I didn't say it wasn't spicy enough.
Challenge accepted.
I said it wasn't as spicy as I remember, which may be a case of my spice palate increasing, my spice tolerance.
Whatever spice level you're willing to do, I'm always going to do one more.
You're always going to be one ladder. You're always going up to 11. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's still extremely hot. Like, it's hot fried chicken, which I feel like we talked about this in the past. Like, it didn't always have good reviews on Yelp. And I think a lot of it is people going there like, oh, fried chicken. I love fried chicken. And then not being prepared for what was coming for them. Which is not the case here.
It's legit hot chicken. It's not like, oh, there's a little bit of spice. Like, you got to be prepared for it, you know? And I'm sure that there's obviously in the world spicier fried chickens. But, like, they're not faking it. You know, this isn't like I've had the hot in many places. This is no offense to Maono, but like the Maono hot is not even, it doesn't register on the scale.
I actually thought the medium was not that far beyond the Maono medium. They actually were more similar, I felt like, in eating them. Because this is the first time I've ever had the bone-in fried chicken there. We both went for they only offer a dark meat selection of legs and thighs, which is a lot of fried chicken. A
healthy amount of chicken, yes.
An extremely unhealthy amount. previously, I think I'd done the strips perhaps once, but usually done the chicken sandwich there. So this was a little bit of a different experience from that standpoint. And I think it was more similar to Maono's fried chicken than I would have realized, not having done the bone-in before. So I would say one thing I feel like, one very small negative is with the dark meat, with the bone-in fried chicken, some of the breading came off and, you know, it didn't stick as well. And I ended up just eating chicken on that part. And there's not a tremendous amount of flavor to the chicken, although it's well-cooked and certainly plenty greasy. So I feel like the strips were a little bit of a better delivery method from that standpoint than the bone-in fried chicken, but this is still a legitimate contender without question.
Wow, legitimate contender. Well, I don't disagree with you, but I think it's the thing about the Nashville style hot chicken is that hot is the flavor palette.
It's not untrue, but I feel like that's still there's still a flavor to that spice.
It was almost like hard for me to separate the heat. And I also was eating it super fresh too. Like I got
that's, it. That's the thing. When you combine the chicken itself being, you know, literally hot in terms of temperature and hot in terms of spice level, that can get become an overwhelming combination. I didn't have it until I came back home. So it wasn't the same level of, again, temperature heat.
No, I was like, got to the chicken part. I was like, okay, finally a break, right? And I tried to like, if a piece fell off, I was like, I'm going to eat that skin. You know, I was like, I'm going to go for this here. I'm not going to fake it. The one thing I should
I mean, I eagerly ate the skin that fell off.
They were out of, you didn't get the hot. They were out of mac and cheese. So I got the fries. And I have to say, the fries were phenomenal.
I think I'm going to have to switch up my order of the fries next time I go.
They were excellent. I ate like a lot of the fries first, just being like, I just need a second here to prepare myself physically and mentally. But I mean, it's not the kind of meal you can have that often, right? Like I was eating it. I was sweating. Oh, yeah. I was sweating. There was like stuff coming out of my nose. You know what I mean? I might have teared up for a second. Like it was pretty hot chicken. And so the first piece that I had, I was like, this is fine. You know, I was like, I'm good. This is maybe a one Modelo spice, but there's a cumulative effect to the heat. And for by the sure. time I got to the second piece of chicken, I was like, this is a two Modelo spice. Oh my God. And I had some like, I was like, this is hot right now. Right. I needed to like take a break for a second. And that's the only reason that I would say that I'm not sure if it is Seattle's best chicken is because it's so much of that one flavor that the complexity of it has a really hard time coming out. It might mean that I would probably actually prefer doing something like the medium where you can get both the heat and the flavor from it. So I think that
maybe you needed to stop trying to prove your manhood in terms of spice level.
It's not proving my manhood. It's besting you.
Well,
in terms of spice level. But if it was something that I was having more often, that would be my otherwise, I think it's pretty perfect, you know. But like if you asked me right now if I could have Cookies chicken or
D&E
chicken, I probably would lean towards one of those over the Sisters and Brothers, but I do think it's close.
Yeah, I mean, I had it slightly behind, you know, Mono and D&E are my top two scores, but I had it in the same category as Super Six, and you know, since I had a slightly lower grade on Cookies than you, so those to me are the five that have kind of separated themselves so far to me.
I think that is a totally fair grouping of chickens.
So I rated it a 90. Where did you put it?
I'm gonna give it an 89.
Okay.
And really can't even just sell short how phenomenal of an experience it is. And you have to go in just being like, look, I'm eating hot chicken, right?
Yeah. Yeah. You know what you're doing.
I think that's the main thing. And I think you're totally right that people could have gone there not really understanding what they were getting themselves into. But it was like, it wasn't, there's the famous description, which we've talked about before from
Danny Chow
at Grantland, I believe, was what he wrote it for, right?
No, it was at the Ringer. I'm confident we have had this exact conversation before. if you're feeling deja vu listening to the podcast,
it wasn't a 24-hour experience eating the chicken. It was like an 8-hour experience eating the chicken.
Also, this is not actually his reference, as it turns out. Now that I'm looking at the piece, it's from the great niece of Thornton Prince, who opened Prince's and invented hot chicken, basically. So,
but yeah, it was an intense experience having it. It was great. It's phenomenal. Definitely. It's one of those things where you're like, that's the thing about eating the hot, right? Like you want to experience, if you're going to go to a fucking hot chicken place, get the hot. That's kind of what I'm like, if we're going into this, I don't want to half-ass it. Does that make sense? It's not.
It does, but if it makes it less pleasant, then I think it's not half-assy.
Sometimes there are things that are less pleasant, but because you're in that situation, right? Like, you could go to almost any restaurant and you could customize it or whatever. It's like having the omakase, right? It's like having the chef special. If you're going there and the chef is like, this is how I prepare food, then you eat the way that they prepare food. You don't just say to yourself, well, I know that I personally want this a little bit dampened, right? You go there and you get the damn hot if you're getting hot chicken. Do you see what I'm saying?
I'm not sure I see what you're saying. I mean, I see what you're saying. I don't think I agree with it. I don't think I agree with that comparison.
If I'm going to go get Nashville-style hot chicken, I want it to be hot. I don't want it to be like, oh, there's a little bit of spice. And if you go somewhere else where you want more of the flavor to stand out, you go to one of those places, right? But like when you walk in that door, when you step through those doors, you have to be prepared for it to be hot chicken.
I mean, again, prepared for it. I just know that I'm going to enjoy it more if I order the medium than if I order the hot. So like that's the goal of the eating experience, is to enjoy the eating. That's the point.
This isn't a fucking Subway here. You know what I mean? Like,
I'm not telling them to like take stuff off of it. You were the one that wanted to be like, hey, can you give me one leg, one thigh, and a chicken tender?
I did not ask, but I would have liked to have tried all three.
They seemed much busier when you called than when I called. So anyways, still, I think a legit contender as we continue our search for Seattle's best fried chicken, which is entering the second half now. We're coming down the mountain. Staying on this food topic, there's something we need to talk about. Yes. You've seen it on Instagram, surely, if you're following at PeltonCast on Instagram, which if you're not, why aren't you? Because
what are you even doing?
It's a lot of food porn on there.
Note if you follow the podcast on Instagram, it's just we're a food podcast.
Exactly. It's, I mean, I don't know what kind of sports stuff we would be putting on there at this point. It's time to talk about Treat Cookies, which had for a long time, for over a year, been operated at the Burien Farmers Market every Thursday before opening up a brick and mortar location on Southwest 152nd Street in Old Burien last Wednesday, which is what I wanted to save this for because, you know, obviously there were like very limited hours. It was 10 to 4 every Thursday. So, you know, if you're working during that time span, you were kind of out of luck for Treat Cookies beforehand. Now it's a bit more flexible in terms of their availability, as long as you order ahead of time, because I was there on Wednesday, the opening day. Went there after getting my COVID, first dose of COVID vaccine. That was my treat myself afterwards. And there was like a dozen people in line in front of me. So I was saved by the fact that I pre-ordered and was able to cut everyone else.
You're trying to make sure that PeltonCast Live happens this August and or September by getting that vaccine dose.
Of course. And by the way, pre-ordering is a classic PeltonCast sneak.
Pre-ordering?
In this case, it was. I saved myself at least 20 minutes in that line.
I'm skeptical whether that counts as a sneak, but okay.
Our definition of a sneak is very broad.
Treat Cookies, Burien's finest, Jay-Z, Biggie Smalls, Burien's finest. There is no better location in the entire city of Burien than Treat Cookies, and maybe...
excluding nobody?
Maybe no better cookie that I've ever had.
Wow. Yeah. I mean,
legit is, I think there's a very good chance these are the greatest cookies I've ever had in my entire life.
I mean, I think one of the things that, you know, we need to say is like the Seattle cookie game has leveled up in the past year. Bell's Cookies, which we talked about last year over the summer and had regularly at that point. And now with Treat, which I just kind of happened across randomly. I was picking up a book at the Burien Library when the Burien Farmers Market was in session. Was like, well, I should go wander over here and see what's going on. And you know, they were one of the nearest booths to the entrance. And I'm like, oh, this looks pretty good. And then tried them and was like, oh my god, you need to try these. And I kept telling Tristan, and for a long period of time, you would not place an order with me when I was going.
I don't think I really grasped what was going on.
The only Thursday that I didn't go between that point and now that they've opened up the store was the day of the trade deadline.
Wow.
That was the only thing that could prevent me from going to Treat Cookies.
My whole perspective has changed since then. I no longer pray to God. I pray to Treat Cookies. Oh, like, no. Come on. we talked a lot about Bell's cookies earlier on, which are still phenomenal cookies. And I think there is a conversation between these two, because they are both so excellent that I think it's really tough. Where it's like, I previously was like, this is the best cookie that I've ever had in Seattle with the Bell's cookies. And now I'm like, this is also the best cookie that I've ever had in Seattle. So I think what you're saying is, given how the cookie game in Seattle has really, really stepped up in recent times, is this summer, we need to do an official search for Seattle's best cookie.
Simultaneous to our search for Seattle's best fried chicken?
Do you not think you can eat both chicken and cookies?
I'm not disputing that. I'm just wondering if it's better from a content standpoint to save it for a different time.
What, in the fall? When do I get to eat all the cookies?
I mean, first off, you're eating the cookies now. No one is preventing you from
eating
the
cookies. I'm only eating the tree cookies now, which actually great. Maybe I'm fine with. In fact, search over.
Oh, wow. I did want to offer everyone, if you do go check it out, a power ranking of the cookies on the current menu that I've tried, because they rotated stuff weekly beforehand. Now it's I think, going to be monthly now that they can offer a wider variety. So my number one cookie thus far is the Carly, which is gluten-free peanut butter with Reese's Pieces.
Yes.
Like, I was a little hesitant. Like, is a gluten-free cookie going to be as good as the others? And the answer is yes. No. I guess the answer was no. It's going to be better than all of them. Like, the peanut butter itself is a great flavor. And then you add the Reese's Pieces on top of it. Oh, man. My number two is the Madison, the classic chocolate chip with sea salt. Can't go wrong with that combo. Mm-hmm. Number three.
By the way, can we just acknowledge as a society how fucking great it is in the year 2021 that everybody is doing sea salt with their chocolate chip cookies? What happened to the previous fucking all of our lives to this point? People weren't like, I never had a chocolate chip cookie with sea salt growing up. And now it's just like, it is the perfect thing.
I still think, as good as these cookies and Bells are, the Hitchcock chocolate chip with sea salt still may be the single best cookie.
Wow.
It's just that it's the only cookie they offer. And like, so it can't compare to the variety that you can get at these other places.
Man, is it gone? Is the Hitchcock cookie gone? Are they on Bainbridge solely?
It's definitely on Bainbridge. They had a non-Hitchcock branded location where they may have been selling the cookie downtown. I can't remember what we concluded about that last year.
We need to get to the bottom of this, though.
We do. All right. The number three, I had the Kenzie, which is a Funfetti cookie, which I think was perhaps new to the menu last week and was excited to try that. Number four, Taylor, which is a frosted sugar cookie. Number five, Cassie, which is a strawberry milk Lucky Charms. Number six, Tennille, a chocolatey capping crunch. And number seven, the lowest of these that I've tried was the Dawn S'mores cookie.
Which is tough to do. I mean, you stay in a Macclesmore, which
it has not been replicated, is my thought. I always go in with high hopes.
I'm not as into the Macclesmore as you are, but I will say the one that you do not have on this list is the Applejack Snickerdoodle, which is, for me, that is number one. I haven't had as many as you've had, but like every time I've had it, the first, if you have them fresh, so can you describe the cookies here a little bit? Like, aside,
I mean,
they're good.
I mean, they're so buttery, clearly, because they're, you know, very light and gooey and flavorful and just delightful from that standpoint.
They stay soft permanently, right? And that's the most essential element that a cookie can have, is for it to be soft. They're like slightly smaller on the outside and then a big glob in the middle. It's like the Mount Rainier of cookies.
And these are good sized cookies if you're pre-ordering them. Like, understand that the, you know, like, it's one cookie is maybe twice, it's similar to Bell's, but maybe even slightly larger, I would say.
They're dense. Like, I was holding a box of cookies that I was bringing to Katie and Ben, and it was like, I don't know how many, maybe there were eight cookies in there, and it weighed 45 pounds. I bench pressed the cookies.
Was this after you had taken out your cookies? Because yes. We had placed an order for 13. I had two. You, I think, had three. So that checks out that it would be eight.
So, wow. Nailed it. Math. But it was like that box was heavy carrying those eight cookies in. And it's just, it is a beautiful thing. Whatever we grew up with cookies has just, it's been destroyed. We literally did not have a cookie before 3 years ago.
Well, look forward to that search for Seattle's best cookie at some point in the future.
Are we going again? Podcast. I never previously wanted to go to Berrien, and now all of a sudden I'm like, give it all to me.
I will be picking some up this weekend. I think they're doing a fundraiser over the weekend. So this Friday and Saturday, 50% of the cookie sales will be going to the I Choose 180 charity, which works to transform systems in justice while supporting young people who are too often harmed by those systems and trying to keep them out of the justice system. So,
wow.
Certainly a great cause.
There we go. 50% to a great cause. 100% of the cookie to you. Hello.
Yeah, as if you needed more reason to hit up Tree Cookies this weekend. There you have it. Should we talk about Seattle sports?
No.
Let's call it a podcast.
For once, cookies again.
Okay, quick update on the Kraken. Pierre LeBrun.
You said the strawberry milk one wasn't great.
It wasn't my favorite.
I like that you were willing to go with that. Anyway, Pierre LeBrun.
Pierre LeBrun of The Athletic reported that the NHL told teams on a GM call last Wednesday that Tuesday, October 12th, is the targeted start date for the 2021-22 regular season, which will, of course, be when the Kraken begin play. It's a week later than normal for the NHL. Training camps would open September 22nd. Obviously, this is all still TBD during the pandemic, but would be a pretty tight turnaround for Climate Pledge Arena, which is scheduled to open sometime during October, according to what a Kraken spokesperson told the Seattle Times recently. So possible they may have to start the season on the road. We have no hot takes this week, sadly. The Mariners remain in second place in the AL West, and Fangraphs remains wildly unimpressed. They did briefly crack a positive run differential. They may still be there, actually. I don't know. I guess they lost badly enough on Sunday. I don't think they are. A Sounders update. A 1-1 draw on Saturday at LAFC, which was not quite a rematch of the last 2 years in the playoffs because LAFC was shorthanded without stars Carlos Vela and Diego Rossi due to injuries. LAFC still got on the board in the opening seconds of this one, drawing a free kick just on the edge of the box in the first 30 seconds of the match. And then Eduard Atuesta went under the Sounders wall for the fastest goal in LAFC history. The Sounders equalized through a Brad Smith header off a rebound from a Raul Ruiz Diaz shot set up by Alex Roldan. Smith's first goal for the Sounders as a defender in the 54th minute. Neither team scored thereafter, which made it a pretty fair draw in terms of both possession and shots. Two teams really kind of even most of this match. It's another LA matchup for the Sounders this Sunday, as they'll again be on national TV for the third consecutive week, hosting LA Galaxy on Sunday at 6 p.m. on FS1. The Galaxy are the only MLS team to win their first two matches. They've scored six goals to tie for the MLS lead, winning a pair of 3-2 thrillers, first against Miami and then against Red Bull New York. Five of those six goals have come from Chicharito, who had a hat trick on Sunday. No other MLS player has more than two goals this season.
Wow.
And it's particularly stunning because Chicharito had just two goals in 12 matches during his first MLS season with the Galaxy last year. The Galaxy will be without USMNT midfielder Sebastian Legette, who's suspended two matches by MLS for posting a video on Instagram showing him using a Spanish anti-gay slur. OL Reign suffered a 2-0 loss last Wednesday at the Portland Thorns in Megan Rapinoe's return to the lineup for the first time since 2019, playing 30 minutes off the bench. Still, the Thorns won to clinch the West Division in the NWSL Challenge Cup at home. That was Portland's third win in as many matches. Rapinoe got the start earlier Tuesday night as the Sounders got their first win. As OL Reign got their first win of 2021 with a 3-2 victory over Chicago Red Stars. Rapinoe played the first half in which the teams traded a goal apiece before the Reign broke things open in the second half with goals from Leah Pruitt and Ziaria King. They conceded the late, but still got the 3-2 win. The first goals of the season for the Reign. So opened the floodgates in a big way. Some marine transactions, a transaction that was whose analysis was actually compared to an NBA trade grant from what I saw. Was that very amusing? Rain traded midfielder Ali Long to Gotham City FC on Tuesday, getting back $80,000 in allocation money, a second round pick in the 2022 draft, and swapping up to the top spot on the NWSL Discovery priority list. They want to add a newcomer to the league. Long, a U.S. member of the U.S. women's national team during the 2019 World Cup, returning home as a native of Long Island. She had yet to play this season due to injury.
And what was the grade that you saw for that?
Wait, what?
That was the Gotham City voice.
Oh, I get it. UW softball, as we turn our attention
What was the grade? You said it was compared
to... I didn't see... I don't think there was actually a grade. They were saying it was just that style of analysis.
Ah, okay.
It was not a literal grade on Sounder at Heart during their OL Reign section. UW softball lost 3 of 4 at number 2 UCLA in a series that emphasized the difference in pitching depth between the Pac-12's top two teams. The Huskies and Bruins split 2 Gabby Plain appearances, with UCLA handing Plain her first loss after a 23-0 start in a 6-1 win on Friday night, touching her for 4 runs in 3 innings before UW went to the bullpen. The Huskies returned the favor on Saturday, chasing player of the year Rachel Garcia after she came on as a reliever in a 7-4 win, with Plain going the distance. Home runs from Morgan Flores and Bailey Klingler powered the UW offense to the most runs allowed by UCLA all season. On Sunday, then, Plain was scratched from her scheduled start as UCLA took the Pac-12 portion of the series with a 4-2 win. In between, the Bruins got a 6-1 win in the non-conference second game of Saturday's doubleheader. At 13-4, the Huskies will now need some help over the last 2 weeks of the conference season to beat out 10-2 UCLA for the Pac-12 title. UW back home this weekend to host Utah, which comes in last in the Pac-12 at 2-13.
Do we know why Gabby Plain was scratched from that start?
I didn't see an update on Sunday and have not probably looked as closely as I should have since then to find out if there's any update. She was in the bullpen throwing at several times during the late innings of that game, but never got in.
So not an injury, possibly just because in softball, pitchers pitch basically every single game.
I am seeing this in UW Daily. It was a tactical choice, so apparently not an injury. Just she did throw 133 pitches on Saturday, although in softball you can, don't have the same issues in terms of accumulating pitch counts.
A tactical choice. That's an interesting one. Were they saving Gabby Plain for future UCLA games?
I mean, there might be some in the Women's College World Series. I don't know.
I mean, that's a legit team from the description there.
UCLA? Yeah. Yeah, they're no joke.
Remember Rachel Garcia from the past also. Like, this is two heavyweights going at it.
I mean, still the reigning national champion since Shannon was crowned last year. They're number 2 in the rankings behind Oklahoma, but Oklahoma, I don't think, has faced the same caliber of competition in the Big 12 as UCLA has in the Pac-12. Now, of course, they get the advantage that every single year they get to play at home in the Women's College World Series. It's not fair bringing the Women's College World Series to Seattle.
That's right. There we go.
Brief women's basketball update from UW. Is new coach Tina Langley announced her coaching staff. She's bringing assistant Latara King with her from Rice and adding Oregon State assistant Kitty Faulkner as the recruiting coordinator, as well as Dan Tackney, who has coached in the NBA and the G League most recently as an assistant coach for the Capital City Go-Go. UW football, some brutal news from spring practice last week.
Oh, my God.
As Zion Tupuola-Fatui suffered an Achilles rupture in practice. That diagnosis was announced last week. ZTF opted against the NFL draft after breaking out with 7 sacks and 3 forced fumbles in just 4 games last season. His first career starts as a third-year sophomore to earn all Pac-12 first-team honors.
God damn it.
I mean, this is just such a bummer for him in particular. Like, we'll see what this means. So the Huskies aren't ruling him out for the season. I'm a little dubious how much he's going to be able to play. My reference frame was that Sidney Jones, you'll remember, suffered an Achilles rupture during his pre-draft workouts on March 25th in 2018. he didn't return to play for the Eagles, who drafted him, until the final week of the regular season on December 31st, which was 9 months later. Although some of that may have been just he's a rookie who needed to get up to speed on the NFL game anyway. It's not the same thing as Zion Tupuola-Fatui, who is clear number one choice aside from health. So, you know, maybe a bowl game, I think, is possible. They said 6 to 10 months. That's an awful aggressive rehab schedule. So you certainly hope he can get back healthy and show a little bit of his wares before potentially entering the NFL draft next year. The combination of that injury and the medical retirement for Laiatu Latu leaves the Huskies a bit thin at edge rusher. Second-year freshman Savelle Smalls likely steps into a featured role alongside Ryan Bowman, with transfer Jeremiah Martin potentially more prominently in the mix than expected. Cooper McDonald, who hasn't played much but was a part of the same recruiting class as ZTF, could also step up this year. Huskies wrap up spring practice on Saturday with their annual spring game.
And obviously there's no way to plan for this, but I think this is the worst part about the players not getting paid in college. And
yeah,
the fact that, I mean, who gives a fuck about how the Huskies are going to fare on the field, right? Like, who cares?
I mean, many people do, in fact, care about that, but it's not the number one thing.
Those people's priorities are wrong. And
you can care about both of them. You don't have to only care about one thing.
See, just him as somebody who is sacrificing his body to be at this institution, right? Like, it's something that you and I go to UW and we're not, at no point is a ruptured Achilles going to cost us millions of dollars or whatever, right?
I mean, it was not at that much risk when we were playing football.
Did you play flag football too?
Damn right I did.
There were some moments that I might have risked it.
I feel like you may have been playing more aggressively than everyone
but
else.
But even if I ruptured my Achilles during the IMA,
it would not have affected your career in music.
Yeah, I would have been fine. And I think the reality is, even if the players are paid in college, they're not going to be paid enough. And the fact is, like, if all players were paid a uniform amount and he was paid a small something, that still isn't enough. In basically every single situation, what you're weighing is, like, in hindsight, he obviously should have gone to the NFL, right? And the thing that you're balancing is, do I give one more year of free labor for the potential of higher future potential earnings in the NFL, right? Like, that's yes. The balance, where it's like, and you see dealing with players who held out. I was listening to a draft podcast today, and they were like, well, this player held out, so they're going to go 15 instead of 10. And it's like, that's kind of a bonkers way to evaluate NFL players, of you held out a year, so you're going to be drafted 5 picks lower. Like, you're not a worse player. You know what I mean? The only teams who are losing in this scenario are the teams that aren't drafting these players, right?
Yeah.
Like, the Pinay Sewell not playing last year and then getting drafted lower, it's like, that's a W for whoever ends up drafting Pinay Sewell. If he would have been picked 4 or whatever, and now he's picked 6, like, it's not a huge difference for him, but there are many players that there's a massive difference for. And you mentioned Sidney Jones, who's somebody who really has never been the kind of NFL player that we anticipated he could have been post that injury, and at least he was a second round pick and got to get paid something. And for ZTF, that may not be the case. And I think that's the worst part of this, is like, if he's a person who, let's say, he went to the NFL this year and is a 4th round pick, in hindsight, that would have been a better scenario. It's just like, it is always better to go because of that risk, because the risk is so great between, you know, maybe he becomes a 1st round pick eventually, or 0. The fact that those two things, that those are the two options, it's just an unfair scenario.
And Trey Adams is another one who recently announced his retirement from football and dealt with a back injury his last year at UW that, you know, affected his stock pretty dramatically.
Oh yeah. I mean, just dealt with, they gave free labor to very, very, very valuable free labor to an institution that absolutely does not need it, and then get basically nothing out of it in the end. And that just is so frustrating.
Get that college education.
Ooh.
Well, this naturally transitions us to talking about the NFL and the Seahawks. Before we get to the draft, a quick news update is they made a couple of moves last week. They re-signed Geno Smith, is back on a one-year deal at the minimum. And this is a move I fully endorse. Like, Geno Smith has experience starting, knows their system well, and does not cost very much of the cap as a backup quarterback too.
But if you ask every single Seahawks fan in preseason, they're going to tell you they want Magoo.
Oh, no. It's also strong tracker at winning the coin toss. I mean, I very, very much a believer in Geno Smith. Although if Cam Newton were available at the minimum, would still take him for the record.
Would you?
Yeah.
Well, Cam Newton's not available at the minimum.
He's not. I know. I'm well aware.
Kaepernick.
Just not concerned about that distraction. They also signed cornerback Pierre Desir, who was on their practice squad in 2016 and in training camp in 2017, but never played for the Seahawks during the regular season.
Pierre Desir never played for the team the regular season?
Nope. Believe it or not.
Are you sure about that?
I am pretty confident.
I remember him having a couple of interceptions, pass breakup. That is wild. Am I thinking of Justin Coleman? Like, what?
You might be.
Went and sat in the Salvation Army drum.
He was claimed off waivers by the Colts after he didn't make the Seahawks roster in 2017, where he developed into a starting corner and then started 8 games for the Jets last year after he was waived by the Colts before being waived again in November and picked up by the Ravens for their practice squad. So, add some depth to the competition at cornerback. It does seem like bad news for the hopes of the Seahawks signing Richard Sherman.
First of all, how dare you?
How dare me? I'm not the one who's signing Pierre Desir and moving Demaryius Randall to corner.
This means
nothing.
Don't
blame the messenger.
This means nothing.
I mean, I'm not completely ruling it out either, but
the day one post compensation.
I think it might be soon. It might be today that was the post comp pick deadline.
They're gonna be announcing that Sherman. We've got 26 minutes left in the day. That's when they announced the Sherman signing.
It is around now.
And Marshawn Lynch and Kaepernick.
Golden Tate.
I don't know if I want Golden Tate back.
Well, he's the one who counts against the comp picks. I'm afraid Colin Kaepernick and Marshawn Lynch do not. Marshawn Lynch only counts as a comp pick for the Seahawks.
I will be fine if they sign Sherman, Kaepernick, and Matt Hasselbeck. I'll be fine.
What's Seneca Wallace up to these days? Mo Morris?
Charles
Bring
Rogers.
Back Mo Morris. Oh, wow. So let's talk about the draft, as the Seahawks have a thrilling 3 picks, just one of them.
I liked it a lot more when we were talking about old Seahawks players.
Do you want to just do that? Continue doing that?
There aren't going to be many new Seahawks players this week.
It's really true. So just one on the first 2 days. They have the 56th overall pick in the second round, the 29th pick in the fourth round, and the 250th pick in the seventh round. Having traded a first and a third in the Jamal Adams trade, they're 5th to the Raiders for Gabe Jackson. They're 6th to the Dolphins during last year's draft for the seventh rounder used on Steven Sullivan, who is no longer on the Seahawks roster. God. And an extra 7th that they had picked up in the Quandre Diggs trade to the Bengals for Carlos Dunlap, in a move I wholeheartedly endorse.
The issue here is not the Quandre Diggs trade.
they got the pick in the Quandre Diggs trade where they gave up, I believe, a 5th last year and got a 7th this year.
Okay. The issue is, maybe for this draft in particular, I guess there's a couple of elements here, which is the inconsistency of the team in general and how they value things, where it's like you could value, even if you're bad, as long as you have an ethos, I feel like that's a perspective, you know? And the Seahawks they throw shit at the wall, and then if that doesn't work, they throw more shit at the wall.
So the Seahawks are the nihilists in this scenario? I mean, first off, Kyle Shanahan made it pretty clear that he is the nihilist when he said he's not even sure if any of us are going to be alive on Sunday.
It was the best thing that Kyle Shanahan has ever said. about the unknowability of the future, right?
I want a podcast with Kyle Shanahan just digging into that quote.
It would probably not be fun at all.
Probably not, no.
It'd be a bunch of football speak. He said it and he would explain it and he'd be like, wow, that was actually incredibly boring. But it's just the inconsistency of it, right? Like, why give up a 6 to get a 7th round pick? Like, what are you doing? Fundamentally, what are they doing? And I think
not that they necessarily knew at this point last year what the draft process was. I mean, one thing that they have made clear, like it's been suspected and, you know, maybe anonymously sourced all along, but one thing they made clear in a piece on Seahawks.com today, or at least this week, is that part of the reason they traded out some of these picks is because of the fact that the draft process was different. And the quote is as quoted by a Third Pelton brother, Mike Sean Dugar. John pretty much nailed that one, Trent Kirchner said. That was talked about when we did it. It was discussed in terms of the amount of information we'll have next year. Who knows what it's going to be? So looking back at it, you're looking at Jamal Adams as your first round pick. You're elated.
Now do next year, because they gave up that first round pick too.
And now also do the money you're paying Jamal Adams compared to a first round pick.
Oh, it's terrible, terrible process.
And now do the third round pick.
It's just like, but also, I actually do not believe that this is the case. I think that Jamal Adams was available for a trade and they wanted to trade for Jamal Adams because having a thing now is a lot more fun than having a thing in the future. A hypothetical draft pick is not as much fun as Jamal Adams right now, right? Like, we understand how fans think, and that's also how the Seahawks think. But they're like, we know Jamal Adams. We don't know about a pick. It could be anything, right?
It could be a boat.
It's like...
No, I guess that's the opposite. That would be the opposite, wouldn't it?
But they're going back.
I do think that was a part of their logic. Because NFL teams really believe all this shit they do helps them draft, even though if you look at the actual evidence, don't draft any better than... Certainly, they don't draft any better than, you know, when they trade up, they don't draft better than the team that's trading down. That's very clear. But also, they don't seem to draft better than the mock drafts, despite all the inside info that they have in terms of medical and scouting players in person and interviews and things like this that, you know, supposedly they don't have this year and had in past years. They think those things are important. Those things are actually probably not important.
Absolutely. But I'm also mostly skeptical about this because making that trade was not like a 2021 Seahawks, 2020-2021 Seahawks thing. It was an all-time Seahawks thing. Like, this was not an uncharacteristic thing to do. They will trade first-round picks and high draft picks for players that they deem unique or special or whatever that they have to go get. And they're willing to go out and get players and pay them large contracts and give up draft picks for it. It's the reason that they have, if there is, which I'm not quite fully there, but like if there is a void of talent on the roster, it's because of all of these decisions leading to this. Like, so it's just like, okay, we did the thing that we always fucking do, and this year we have an explanation for it. But what was the explanation when you did it for Jimmy Graham? And what was the explanation when you did it for Percy Harvin? Why were those drafts tainted? You understand what I'm saying?
They never gave up 2 first-round picks, which is the other thing.
The second first-round pick, that changes everything. In the draft that they actually will be able to evaluate talent for, that's the difference.
It's true, but I mean, it does change something in terms of the price. Yeah, it's a substantially higher price they paid than for Percy Harvin or Jimmy Graham.
I mean, you can argue that Jamal Adams was a more valuable asset than those two players.
He's younger than Graham was, and he also had 2 years left on his rookie contract, whereas they immediately renegotiated Percy Harvin. So that's
traded the pick that became Jordan Brooks for goddamn Minka Fitzpatrick. Ugh.
Well,
we would have been done with this. We would have had a fun fucking weekend ahead of us.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm highly skeptical. I understand that this is a thing. These are words that are coming out of people's mouths that are on Seahawks.com. But I strongly believe that these are explanations. These are retronymic explanations of what happened. They wanted Jamal Adams, and they went and got Jamal Adams. They paid the price that it costs to get Jamal Adams, and so they did it. That's fine, right? you don't need to be like, you don't need to give an explanation for it and be like, this draft's horseshit. The next draft also, the first round pick, picks 2 through 7, those will be fine. But they're just explaining a thing that doesn't need explaining, in my opinion.
I mean,
that's
I
what
think
sports it, is, your whole fucking industry.
Wow. Well, look. Again, it was a positive comparison, the Ellie Long analysis to my trade crates. Positive comparison. They also apparently don't care about next year's fourth round, since that also went in the Jamal Adams trade. Oh, no, we got a fourth rounder. I'm sorry. That's the opposite. Seahawks got a fourth rounder for the Jets. So they're working with a full complement of picks, just having traded a first for a fourth. But I think one question it potentially informs, if they think this year's draft is much more uncertain, then it may not be as important for them to trade down and accumulate more than the current three picks they hold. So that's one thing we're going to find out, I think, on Thursday or on Friday. We're not going to find out anything about the Seahawks on Thursday.
But I also don't think that's going to be the case. They're going to trade down still. Like, they're saying these words, but when they're in that moment and the chance to trade down comes, they're going to trade down, and that is the right process to do. They need to trade down. It's literally the only thing the Seahawks can do in this draft is trade down.
I mean, it's the thing they do. The only thing they do well in any draft is trade down, you might say. One of the things I like to do generally is to have a range of picks across the draft. And that's one thing they don't have this year. So, you know, if they can add a fifth or a sixth to replace the fact that they don't have any of those picks and maybe go down, you know, 4 or 5 spots and still think that the player, one of the players they want is going to be on the board. I think that's the reasonable expectation in terms of trading down. So the next question is positions to target. And for me, I would probably like to see the second round pick and the fourth round pick be used offensively. I think, you know, wide receiver and interior offensive line, but probably specifically center, are the two spots I'd like to see them add. But I think a lot of people would also add corner to that.
Sure. You there's have three no picks. Like, I don't know. They're not particularly great picks. Like,
but do you have a take for what kind of player you'd like to see them add? I mean, obviously, it's ridiculous with the 56th and 129th pick to talk about specific players, but positions, I think it's reasonable to talk about.
I mean, I suppose I agree that we all know, we've talked about this over and over and over again, the most important thing you can do in a draft is have as many picks as possible, fail, done, right? Like, that's the chance for that happening is over. Drafting positions of value versus positions not of value is a thing that they can still achieve. Is there any evidence that they're going to do that? Absolutely not.
I mean, they may do it by accident. Just like they've already drafted enough players at line, off-ball linebacker, non-pass rushing defensive ends. They've already, you know, I guess they could draft interior defensive line, which is not a position of value, but they could go, or no, I guess run-stopping defensive tackle would be the low-value position they could draft.
They could draft a player who will never play a game.
I mean, in the fourth round, that's certainly possible. Chris Harper and, you know, a variety of wide receivers they've drafted have never played it and made it to their roster. I think if you look at the analysis,
I care about offensive line and wide receiver the most. I think are the two positions that are these players going to play? Like, if you're
second rounder should play.
I suppose so. I mean, I'm thinking of this as they are going to trade down from that second round pick 56. I'm thinking of it as a third rounder. Like, will they play? Probably a little bit. But, like, nobody's counting on this player, right?
No, but, I mean, if you're taking a slot receiver.
If you're the Seahawks, you don't count on your first round pick for multiple years.
I mean, Jordan Brooks did eventually play. I would say that the cornerback class looks particularly deep in this range of the draft. Third Pelton brother Danny Kelly has 8 corners between 46 and 72 on his board for the Ringer in their NFL draft guide, including Elijah Molden.
Hello.
And very Seahawks-y Syracuse cornerback Ifeatu Melifonwu. You'll recall that when we previewed whatever draft it was in 2018 with Third Pelton brother Zach Whitman, Obi Melifonwu was a 3 Sigma athlete in his projected spark score analysis of measurables back then, though Melifonwu has not really panned out in the NFL. But
is he still in the league?
I'm not sure if he is.
I feel like he's not.
He's played for a couple different teams, but I don't think he is currently.
I mean, Obi Melifonwu is
a reserve future contract with the 49ers, so he will be in training camp in a likely.
Oh, he's part of joining all that talent on the Niners. Obi Melifonwu is maybe more so than almost any player that we've talked about in the draft process in explanation for the fact that any individual player you cannot count on being a good player. It may be outside of like the top five or something like that, but like the territory that the Seahawks have been in, if you're circling any individual player and saying that player is going to be a good NFL player, that is an incorrect way to view things.
Which is why you should trade down. Yeah. So lastly, let's talk about the Huskies and this year's draft. Joe Tryon is the top-rated UW product in ESPN's rankings at number 37 overall. Danny has him number 41 and comped him to a former Seahawk in Patrick Kearney.
Wow, all right.
Levi Onwuzurike in that same range at number 42 on ESPN's board. Danny has him as his top Husky at number 37, touting Onwuzurike's potential to play on all three downs as an interior defensive lineman.
Okay.
And then Molden, number 49 on both of those rankings. And then, so it's going to be those two guys very likely in the second round on Friday night in day two of the draft. And it's going to be a while. The only other prospect rated by ESPN from UW is cornerback Keith Taylor as a possible day three pick at number 256.
Yeah, and I wouldn't be shocked if somebody sneaks into the first round.
No, I mean, they're close enough to it that it's potential. It's definitely possible. I'm not sure it's likely, but it's possible.
This is my bold prediction here. I think we will hear a UW player's name called on Thursday night.
Okay.
It's kind of fascinating. I mean, heading into this draft with the Seahawks, and I feel like it's the draft that I've been least engaged in since, I mean, maybe the year they drafted Aaron Curry. Like, it's been a while.
Yeah. I mean, certainly, like, we've become more engaged by virtue of doing this podcast and often doing a pre-draft.
But I mean,
the team being good doesn't necessarily make you more engaged in the draft because you don't have as high a draft pick.
Yeah, well, there's definitely, like, there have been players who all see on other teams, right? Like Montez Sweat. Right. And it's like, oh, man, I remember talking about him in the draft process. Players like that were this year, we don't get to do that. You know, we don't get to have players that we're going to be bummed about missing out on or upset that they didn't really fall to the Seahawks, because picking where they're picking, looking, like you said, at any individual player is just, it's folly to consider that, which doesn't mean that they can't draft good players. Like, I feel like,
no.
Oh, the Seahawks have drafted very good players, whether their process has been good or bad. Like, I mean, they drafted DK Metcalf a couple of years ago, right? Like,
I mean, the dominant factor in the draft is randomness.
They've done good things, and they may draft a very good player with one of these picks.
I mean, the question, by the way, is which Huskies are going to go to NFC West teams?
All of them.
And the Niners draft at 43, the Cardinals draft at 49. That is like prime territory for those two teams to take Huskies. The Rams at 50 don't have their first pick until 57. That could be a little more difficult. So
they'll figure it out. Elijah Molden, doesn't he feel like a Ram?
He does, yes.
But I feel like it's a misnomer to be down on the Seahawks in general versus just like, they may draft a good player, the process is bad whether they draft a good player or not. And I think that's the main thing. But I also want to talk about, for a second at least, around the NFC West and the team picking at number 3, which is maybe the most important pick of the entire draft so far, at least the first round, that everybody has circled, and the 49ers, what they're going to do.
I mean, the draft starts at number 3. We have a very good sense. What's going to, we know Trevor Lawrence is going to Jacksonville. Jaguar fans are already buying him wedding gifts on his registry. We have a very good sense that Zach Wilson is going to be number two to the Jets. And that means the draft starts with the 49ers after their trade up to number three. And the reporting this week has been that, you know, while they traded up to number three because they felt confident in Mac Jones as a quarterback prospect at that point, that what they've seen from Trey Lance in the period of time since then has made that a legitimate conversation. It doesn't sound like Justin Fields is in the mix, but still some uncertainty about how they go. And I think you could make the case, given the importance of the quarterback position and the importance of this pick, that who the 49ers take and whether that player pans out is more important to the Seahawks' future than whoever they draft this week.
Wow.
I mean, legitimately, like, if the 49ers get a great quarterback and add it to, you know, all the skill position talent that they have, all the defensive talent that they have, that's bad news for the Seahawks. And it's probably a much bigger deal than whoever you draft at 56.
Yes.
So
I just was really chafing at this idea that, well, I guess a couple of things, like both on the positive for the Niners side, the people were, I feel like Mac Jones has kind of been treated like a joke, right?
100%.
And the reality is, like, draft, there's no way to predict this beyond, again,
we were pretty confident that Justin Herbert was going to be bad in the NFL last year.
Oh, yeah. And Josh Allen, too, right? Like, there's no way that Josh Allen should have led a team that far or be as good of a quarterback as he is.
He was a legit MVP contender.
I mean, positive and negative, either way, predicting the success of quarterbacks. I mean, like, I think that Trevor Lawrence will be a very good quarterback. And beyond that, I have no idea for anybody else.
I mean, people say quarterbacks, but it's partially just you draft quarterbacks high. It's not like other positions are that much more certain than quarterback. Like, the draft is very unpredictable in general. That's the dominant factor is randomness.
Yeah. So I mean, it's why it's a bad idea to trade for the number three pick. Like, the 49ers
trade,
process is
trade
bad.
Trade two first-round picks.
Yeah. Oh, no matter who they select, even if they turn out to be a phenomenal quarterback, again, people will go back, again, retroactively and say this was a great decision, but I think that's only specifically referring to the name. But
it really is, yes.
The
term is just retroactively.
I don't like it. The
hindsight? Are you looking for hindsight?
They'll go back and say that it was a great pick or whatever. Like, right, like trading up for Julio Jones. Julio Jones ends up being a good player, and you're like, it was a great decision. But there's a scenario where Julio Jones doesn't turn out to be a good player. I don't, as a Seahawks fan, I would probably prefer them taking Mac Jones, but I would not even venture to predict the future success of Trey Lance vis-a-vis Mac Jones, because I think it is an impossible thing to do.
I would not laugh at the 49ers because karma is going to turn that around on you.
And it's just like, nobody fucking knows. Like, okay, so here's the part that I chafe about. That's the positive side for the 49ers. The negative side is, I'm really skeptical about some of the chatter around the 49ers and how that team is perceived. I understand it's because they went to the Super Bowl 2 years ago. I get it. But like, this idea that, I feel like there's an idea that the 49ers can have any quarterback. Kyle Shanahan can have any quarterback at all, and he'll be successful. And somehow, Kyle Shanahan has had three seasons as 49ers head coach, and two of them has had a losing record, but it doesn't matter which quarterback he has. And I do not understand that the dialogue that has surrounded Kyle Shanahan. And I think there's really something about being a, like, about being a successful white offensive coordinator. And
well, you don't need to specify that.
The difference between a white offensive coordinator and a black offensive coordinator is the head coach title. But being a successful white offensive coordinator, and if you have a good season, you are a good offensive coordinator forever. But any other person, if you have a good season and some bad seasons, then there's a difference. Like, then you're not that good. And I think that the way that people talk about Kyle Shanahan I believe if I recall correctly, the 49ers had incredible injury luck the year that they went to the Super Bowl.
I mean, probably. Like, they also probably had close to the worst injury luck last year.
Now do the year they went 4-12. Like, he has had two losing seasons. Or sorry, he's had four seasons as head coach. 6-10, 4-12, 13-3, 6-10. Three out of his four seasons, he has had a losing record. And there's this idea that Kyle Shanahan's offense could have any quarterback. Which is just like, that is such complete horseshit. Pete Carroll has a better claim to having any quarterback and having a winning record.
Their adjusted games lost last year due to injury was, according to Football Outsiders, was 166.6. Do you want to guess what the next highest was in the entire NFL?
I don't want to guess that because there's other seasons beyond that season.
134.8.
Okay.
The difference between them and New England, who was number two, and this is including games missed due to COVID-19, is bigger than the difference between the Patriots and the team that was in seventh.
Wow, the curse of Jimmy G, am I right? But do you understand what I'm saying? Like,
I'm sorry, the team that was in eighth, I shorted them a spot.
Kyle Shanahan has had three losing seasons as a head coach and one winning season as a head coach. And there is a dialogue around him talking about how potent this offense is for the 49ers, that they could have any quarterback. And he seems to have been able to have had an opportunity to have any quarterback and has lost three of those seasons. And also, I'm pretty skeptical about the talent as well. We're just like, oh yeah, you're putting a quarterback there with Brandon Ayuk. It's just like, okay. Deebo Samuel, George Kittle, like there is Trent Williams.
Are you dismissively saying George Kittle?
There is one very good player there. But would you take, if you could have the weapons, so to say, outside of quarterback, Brandon Ayuk, Deebo Samuel, George Kittle, and Trent Williams randomly included, versus Tyler Lockett, DK Metcalf?
Yes.
I'm sorry, but the wide receivers the Seahawks have are so much better than those 49ers wide receivers, and having a very good tight end is less important than having a wide receiver like DK Metcalf. Like, these are not, they're speculative wide receivers.
Reason the wide receivers look so good is because they're playing with Russell Wilson. I think what you're not understanding is, like, everything, you can't just look at pure performance. Everything has to be adjusted for the context in which you're playing.
But they're also playing within the confines of a Seahawks offense. Like, DK Metcalf is somebody who would be good in basically any offense. And I think George Kittle,
probably. We've never seen him in literally any other offense. So how can you say that? And he was dressed.
Wow. Did you not watch the Egg Bowl 2017?
I really didn't know. Did you?
I'm sure there are some monster performances. But I think that George Kittle is somebody who probably would be good in any offense. And DK Metcalf is also somebody who would be good in any offense. And having a wide receiver like DK Metcalf is more important than having a tight end like George Kittle. Like, I don't think that you can look at this 49ers team that went 6-10 last year and say, or went 4-12 previously, and say, this is a team that could have any quarterback. And I really, really chafe at that idea. Like, they have to nail this pick, like you're talking about for the Seahawks benefit. They have to nail this pick more than basically any other team in the draft has to nail a pick, not because they're going into Kyle Shanahan's offense, because Kyle Shanahan needs a good quarterback, just like every single other coach and a coordinator.
But he's never had a good quarterback in San Francisco. Like, you seem to be defining this as if Jimmy Garoppolo is a good quarterback.
But you've only seen Jimmy Garoppolo as a starting quarterback in San Francisco. So if you don't think Jimmy Garoppolo is a good quarterback, that's on Kyle Shanahan.
I mean, do you know what Jimmy Garoppolo's record is in San Francisco? What do you think his record is?
It's probably a winning record.
It's probably a winning record? It's 22-8.
So then why are you telling me he's never had a good quarterback? How can you view Jimmy Garoppolo in a bubble and say that he's not a good quarterback and has a 22-8 record? Maybe Jimmy Garoppolo is a good quarterback and Kyle Shanahan fucking sucks.
I guess so. I don't know. Like, you can also look at his track record as an offensive coordinator. I mean, I think it's overrated how well he did with Matt Ryan relative to how well Steve Sarkisian did with that same offense because of some red zone luck. But it's not like they did poorly the year that they went to the Super Bowl.
But why then is Jimmy G not a good quarterback, but Kyle Shanahan is a good coordinator?
I feel like you thought that Jimmy Garoppolo was a good quarterback before they traded for the number three pick.
I'm just saying that changed
your opinion of Jimmy Garoppolo somehow.
I'm not responding to Jimmy Garoppolo himself. I'm responding to the media context that has rallied around Kyle Shanahan.
The number one thing you need to remember is to be fucking afraid of everyone else in the NFC West at all times.
And you know who I'm afraid of the most? I'm afraid of Jimmy goddamn G. He's 22-8 as a starting quarterback. Why then didn't Kyle Shanahan
trust him to throw a single pass in the playoffs and still made the Super Bowl? I don't know. That's probably a reason.
Every other quarterback that they've had has
gonna have to hit you with a watch the games from the 2019 playoffs. The way they rode that running game.
You can only ride a running game if you have a quarterback who could throw the ball. Like, I'm sorry, but you can't just be like they rode the running game. The quarterback can't throw for shit, but the defense has had no idea. Like, that's
how many passes do you think Jimmy Garoppolo threw in the NFC Championship game in 2019?
Just because he didn't.
No. Answer my question. Answer my question. How many passes do you think he threw?
12.
No, 8. He threw 8 passes.
That doesn't.
He scored 37 points.
That doesn't mean that Jimmy G was doing something wrong. What about the other games? Like, okay, so you're willing to admit that there is a difference between Jimmy G and Nick Mullins and CJ Beathard?
Were all of those starts
they were injured, but the Jimmy G starts they weren't?
It has now become clear. I mean, look, the George Kittle injuries, I think, coincided with the period that Jimmy Garoppolo was out of the lineup, although their record with Kittle was not as strong last year as I thought it was. It was only 3-5. I mean, he threw 19 passes in their first round game. He threw for 131 yards. Again, I think they won that on their strength of their running game as
or
well.
Or on the strength of their defense, too. And Robert Saleh's gone. Like, there's so much more that is going into this. I'm just saying, I really chafe at this idea that Kyle Shanahan could have any quarterback, but he needs to trade up for the third pick to get a quarterback. He could have anybody. He doesn't give a fuck. It could be a person off the street.
Considering the possibility that there are different people making these points?
This is a point that is consistent across the board. Have you seen anybody else make a different point?
No. Don't give me this bullshit that something is consistent across the board.
This is like saying
ESPN says something.
God,
ESPN doesn't say anything. An individual person at ESPN says something. Do you know how different my opinions are than a lot of other people that work for ESPN? They don't want to be judged on my opinion. I know that for sure.
ESPN says a lot of things.
People at ESPN say a lot of things because it's a large company that employs many people to offer opinions.
People say things. Businesses don't say things.
And you know who isn't employed to give their opinions about things?
Who?
You. Well, music. I guess you are employed to do that. Huh? Just definitely not sports.
Jimmy Garoppolo, you're not employed to give your opinion about football either. I'm just. Well. Do you understand what I'm saying? Like,
no,
you really don't.
I think you're strawmanning the hell out of this argument, as usual.
Oh, God.
I mean, yes, is Kyle Shanahan overrated? Of course. All coaches that are rated highly are overrated. And all coaches that are rated poorly are underrated. Because coaches are, for the vast majority of coaches, are about the same. And what determines their success is the quality of their roster and how healthy it stays.
Yes. They're going to have traded up for the third pick in the draft, and people are going to go on about how, Kyle Shanahan could have any quarterback. But he needed to trade three first-round picks.
This is a straw man argument. You show me one example of this argument actually literally being made. Besides me maybe saying it about Nick Mullins. But that probably would have been more positive about Nick Mullins than Kyle Shanahan.
The Pelton cast tapes of both of us being like, look, Nick Mullins is better than Jimmy G.
Which, Lee, you're much too lazy to ever go look those up.
Oh, Lord. I'm gonna record the draft on Thursday night. And they're going to be like, look, Kyle Shanahan doesn't care who his quarterback is. He just felt like he needed to have the third pick in the draft for this quarterback. It's going to be on ESPN.
I mean, I think it's probably more that they felt like there were multiple strong quarterbacks in this draft, and that's what made them comfortable trading up.
Five guys.
So we'll find out on Thursday which of those players it will be. And then Friday, the Seahawks will enter the draft.
Maybe.
Well, true. Saturday. But I mean, the third round is also conducted on Thursday, okay, so on Friday. So I think they'll be Friday. I think they'll be okay.
All right, A selection will be made on Friday.
We will not be conducting an emergency pod unless the Seahawks trade Earl Thomas, or at least you think the Seahawks have traded Earl Thomas, and then they draft a running back in the first round.
Look, once the comp pick deadline is over with, they're going to sign Earl Thomas.
He's not affected by the comp pick deadline.
Marquand Manuel.
he's on their defensive coaching staff.
They're going to sign him. Michael Boulware.
He didn't play for the Seahawks.
Not Peter. Oh, he did. Yes. Michael Boulware did. Peter Boulware. All
right. I was mixing them up. Yes.
God. And Patrick Kearney.
Oh, boy. On that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.